Okay, and we are moving on to conservation, so I wasn't prepared. I'm handing this over to Chairman Bivens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did you want the gavel? He likes that.
Yeah, he always likes that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. He likes that.
Thank you. Let it be known that I do have
you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first order of business for the Conservation Committee is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have been distributed. Entertain a motion. Martin, a second. Hickson, thank you very much. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Before we proceed with the briefings, I want to mention that committee item number 6, the land exchange in San Saba and Lampasas counties at Colorado Bend State Park, and committee item number 7, new environmental review MOU between Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and TxDOT have been withdrawn at this time. Going on to committee item number 1, update on TPW progress in implementing the TPW Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things that I want to mention. Last time, as you will recall, Robert Goodrich gave a very comprehensive proposal of some of the work that law enforcement in particular is doing in concert with inland fisheries and others to combat the spread of these aquatic invasive species. And Mr. Duggins, I believe you and others suggested that we could better utilize our contacts through boat registration to help get the word out about the concern about zebra mussels and quagga mussels coming into the state. We'll let you know we've done that, working with the communications team and fisheries and law enforcement. They've developed a couple of brochures to help address this. It's now going out in the mailings to everybody that is registering their boats. You know, they have to do that every 2 years. So very, very good suggestion, but I want to let you know we're following up on that, and that's reaching 500,000 folks. So I think that will be enormously helpful. Back in December, we opened a new state park. Not every day we get to do that in Texas. So we're very, very proud of that. That is the third and last of the Parks and Wildlife's official World Birding Center properties down in the valley. I see Walt and Scott. They ought to take a lot of pride in that. This was a great accomplishment at Resaca de la Palma, 2,000-acre park down in the Rio Grande Valley. We're already seeing a lot of family use of that place. And when you get down to Brownsville or the Rio Grande Valley, I hope you'll go visit it. They've just done a remarkable job down there, and we're very, very proud of it. We talked a lot. Scott gave a very comprehensive presentation about the impact that the agency and the resource felt as a function of Hurricane Ike. Did want to let you know that we did get some emergency money from NOAA, about $7 million, to help invest in rebuilding seagrass meadows, oyster beds, and public boat ramps, and particularly to help facilitate more commercial access. As you will recall, Scott pointed out a lot of boat ramps, particularly in Galveston Bay, were damaged, so we'll put those dollars to good use. Coming up later this month in February, the American Fisheries Society is going to be meeting in Fort Worth. Our team is going to be helping to sponsor a symposium as part of that on golden algae research. That became a major problem for us when we discovered it at the Dundee Fish Hatchery in Electra. That's popped up at other fish hatcheries. You have a little bit of naturally occurring golden algae in summer river basins around the state, such as the Pecos River. Inland Fisheries team are bringing together all of the scientists to help synthesize what they know about golden algae now and how we can incorporate that into our management efforts. So the dates for that conference, the 27th through the 31st, at the Radisson Fort Worth Fossil Creek Hotel for any of you who are going to be up that way at that time. Last thing I'll mention, we had a very generous anonymous donation that came through the foundation to help us look at kind of wildlife species response to the wildfire last March at the Shap. And so our biologists down there have helped put together a proposal to look particularly at small mammal and avian response to the wildfire. We're working with Cesar Clayburgh, a Wildlife Research Institute, to get that instituted, but a very generous $100,000 gift to help facilitate it and help us learn from it. So that's my report on that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I would like to ask Scott, how many years has it been since we began the World Birding Center project?
That's right. You got to be in love to start, didn't you?
I was off the hook for this meeting. For the record, Commissioner, my name is Scott Borff, the Deputy Executive Director for Operations. The World Reading Center began in concept, I believe, in the late 1980s, yeah. So it precedes me by quite a bit, so I wouldn't try to tag the exact date to it. I will tell you that we have been working on this very diligently since the mid-90s to get this project up and going. I think there was a lot of pre-operational debate about some of the political issues about where the headquarters would be and how many sites there would be, but we certainly have been working very diligently for the last 12 or 14 years to get this project to completion.
I want to thank you for all your efforts on that. I mean, it's been a big project, but I think the results are admirable and they're certainly impressive.
I'll accept the compliment on behalf of State Park. Those folks have put in a lot of time down there. We've had good regional directorship from Russell Fishbeck down there. We have great site managers. This has been a project that the park should be very proud of.
Thank you.
We thank you.
Committee item number two, Dove Research Briefing, Clay Brewer.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, I'm Clay Brewer, the Interim Director of the Wildlife Division. I've asked Corey Mason to present the briefing concerning Dove Research, and I'd like to take this moment to introduce Corey. This is his very first commission presentation, so Corey is the newest member of the Small Game and Habitat Assessment Program. He received his bachelor's and master's in wildlife management from Stephen F. Austin University. Corey has worked for us since 2001. As a wildlife management area biologist, East Texas waterfowl biologist, and has recently been promoted to the Webless Migratory Game Bird Program Leader. So Corey is one of our best and brightest. We're proud of him and proud that he is serving in this new role. So I'll turn it over to Corey.
Thank you. Purposes of the record, I'm Corey Mason, Webless Migratory Game Bird Program Leader. I'm here to brief the commission today on dove research in Texas and how the information gained is used to guide us in our management decisions. Look at a few of the benefits here. Dove are beneficial to Texas for recreational and economic reasons both. Mourning dove specifically to start with are the most abundant game bird in North America and are just one of the most abundant birds in North America, period. An estimated 5 million are harvested annually in Texas by 326,000 hunters, which constitutes over a quarter of our nation's harvest. White-winged dove now occur in over 80% of our counties, and we harvest about 1.5 million of these birds annually. Dove hunting has an economic benefit to Texas of around $316 million. Additionally, a little over 3,000 jobs are related to the dove hunting industry. Research is a very important component to parks and wildlife, and we believe that research is important to management, and our management decisions need to be based on sound biological data. Along these same lines, the Parks and Wildlife of the state of Texas is a member of the Central Management Unit. The Central Management Unit is comprised of 14 states and their associated conservation agencies in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the purpose of this group is to work cooperatively to ensure management of dove resources in the central United States and ensure their management, longevity, and maintain the resource. Now, Parks and Wildlife has been led a lot of these critical research projects identified by the Central Management Unit. Since 1993, we've completed 30 dove-related studies aimed at management issues and published 50 scientific articles in peer-reviewed journals and currently have 5 in the review process. Now, we certainly don't have time to look at 30 research projects, so I've summarized a few of the key research projects that had some of the most significance to management-related decisions. First project here is looking at landscape changes along our call count survey routes. A band reporting rate study conducted with Dr. Dave Otis, the United States Geological Survey. Studies aimed at survival and harvest rates from banding on mourning dove and white-winged dove. And a recruitment rate study looking at trying to determine the cause and effect relationships of juveniles coming into the population and the importance of that. Now look at some of the use of these results. Looking at our call count surveys and the habitats associated with them, we were able to detect the biases and indices associated with these surveys and lines. So we were able to improve our survey techniques now using distance sampling. Now we use distance sampling in our call count surveys for mourning dove as well as our point count surveys for white-winged dove. We've been able to provide estimates of survival, harvest, and age ratios, all very important factors in managing migratory game birds. We've been able to derive breeding population abundance estimates for mourning dove estimated around 20 to 25 million birds. We've been able to gain valuable insight in white-winged dove populations and factors influencing those. Studies related to things such as breeding ecology, nesting success, disease, parasites, life history, and possible range expansion. Some of the current research projects that we have going on, we have an attitude survey looking at hunters' attitudes and perceptions about lead and non-lead shot. We're currently working on a lethality study of lead and non-lead shot. Now, some of you are probably aware this study received a little controversy last year. We've gained a tremendous amount of insight from that, learned from those experiences, and are planning to move forward on that. This is a very sound project based on some studies done in the early 80s, looking at waterfowl out of Missouri and Louisiana. The rigor of these studies has been proven in peer-reviewed journals and will provide us some very valuable information on developing lethality tables specific to a dove-sized bird. These tables exist for ducks and geese, but they simply do not exist for doves. Look at the prevalence of lead in the environment, as well as lead in embedded, ingested, free-ranging wild-flying dove. And looking at trying to determine dove population density using our distance sampling techniques. Current research projects aim specifically at white wings, are trying to identify wintering areas using radioisotopes and DNA. The pros of this is it enables us to do it in a much more efficient manner and not having to mark recapture birds. Trying to model populations and nesting ecology and the factors that influence them. Developing aging criteria specifically for hatching your birds, which is extremely difficult to do. And continuing to monitor survival, harvest, and recruitment of white wings. Trying to analyze historic data for management objectives to let us know where we've been so we can analyze, see where we're going in the future. Now, the way that we plan to use some of this research, the Hunter Attitude Survey is trying to determine perceptions and preferences regarding lead and non-lead shot. Like I mentioned earlier, our lethality study is trying to determine the efficiencies of these loads, lead and non-lead loads. Trying to identify some specific white-winged nesting areas in Central and South America. Be able to better understand some of the ecological factors affecting white-winged populations. Kind of the cumulative effect of a lot of these projects will allow us to better understand and develop a harvest management strategy for white wings. White wings are a really interesting bird. It's one of the few birds that's expanding its range. Yeah. There's so much about birds that are declining, and white wings are one of the few birds that are moving out and out and out. We're working to continually try to modify our surveys to improve the sensitivity of our results so that hopefully someday we're able to detect the differences in population and be able to attribute those to population level effect due to habitat changes, regulation changes, or hunting pressures. And in concluding, our research has been important at national and state level for conservation planning and will continue to be. We utilize university staff and graduate students whenever possible. It results in increased opportunities for our hunters, and a quick example of that is in the valley in our white wing areas, the increased bag limit of mourning dove from 2 to 5. And it, additionally, us having this information, particularly on white wings and mourning dove both, will serve for protection for our hunters against potential unwarranted regulation changes. And a driving force in our management and research is trying to replace perceptions with facts. That's what I have. I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
I have one question.
Yes, sir.
With the by one thought, as you make this presentation, Corey, and I'm really not speaking to you. I speak to Clay. This is a wonderful presentation. You know, with the huge debacle that we had last August, the two last days in August, I would have loved to have had this presentation from you or anybody else prior to these last 2 days of August. I think what happened in the last 2 days of August was it was worse than a right cross from Muhammad Ali, and it came to the Parks and Wildlife quicker than Ali's right cross. It was like a firecracker exploding in our face. I realize that Mr. Smith didn't know anything about it. Mr. Boyf didn't know anything about it. And none of the commission, I think, knew anything about it. And it was a embarrassing situation for Parks and Wildlife. And, you know, I just hope that we have learned something about this and let the message go out that that sort of situation never again. Finds a place within this wonderful agency that provides so many wonderful experiences for so many Texans and out-of-state people too.
Well, I guess I do want to respond to it, and I appreciate those comments. I think everybody in this room, and certainly on staff, I mean, we too agree that the circumstances that unfolded were obviously regrettable, and have we learned from it? We absolutely have. I do want to clarify a point, just in fairness to our team that have been working on this research, because the team did brief myself and Scott about the whole range of lethality tests that were being considered and evaluated, and so. And to be fair, too, we supported that. As you saw there, Texas is the 800-pound gorilla in dove and dove management and dove hunting and dove research. And as this issue about how do we handle the concerns about lead shot continue to escalate, we should reflect back on the conversation we had this morning about GAR, and that is that we need to be in a position scientifically to be able to provide answers and information and data both biologically but also socially. And so, you know, that was the genesis for this suite of dove research topics. I think the point that you're making very clearly to us, Commissioner, is could we have done a better job communicating in advance the purposes of the research, what we were trying to accomplish, why we were doing it, why we felt it was important to all of the relevant stakeholders. And the lesson learned from that is, yes, absolutely, and I don't think any of us disagree. And we are doing better. And I feel very good about where the division is now in terms of putting in place communication plans to sort of assess those kind of threshold of concerns and risk and reputation that you're getting at. And so I think there is a very deep and genuine interest by all of our biologists that are very, very committed to that. And so I'm proud to see the results of it and appreciate your comments very much that if we don't learn from this experience, then that will be a failure of the department. And I appreciate that sentiment.
I'd like to add to that. I appreciate your comment very much. I'm proud of our folks. I'm proud of the job they do, the work ethic, the science. I'm proud to be part of this group. Now, we didn't do everything perfect, probably won't every time. But we have implemented some changes, like Carter said. We're looking at our regulatory processes, all of them, not just when it comes to dove or dove research. We're taking a hard look at all of them, and I think we have some pretty successful models. The big game model works pretty well. We're going to look at some of these other programs and figure out a process, a cycle that we can give you guys that you understand how all of this works. You can pull up that calendar and you know what's coming, and it's been a tough thing. I don't know, stepping into this, Carter calls it purgatory. It's a little bit different view, and there's lots of things happening at once, but we have some really good things going right now, and I think we will continue to improve. But I do appreciate your comments, point well taken.
Yeah. I'd just like to say thanks for your comments as well, and we are working towards addressing some needs.
Commissioner Duncan.
Yeah, I have a question. What do you mean by a call count survey route?
Excellent. The call count survey route is an end of season which we perform our surveys in late May. It's a method in which we're trying to determine the number of dove we have. It's done across the entire United States, and what we do is we have our biologists mention it's the method in which we use to survey dove. They drive to a specific point and listen for a specific interval for cooing males, for calling males. It's an end of season which we can track over time the number of male dove through time. So it's a survey technique for us. And these are routes that are driven year after year after year. So we are looking at our research right now, trying to determine if differences that we're finding in dove population are a reflection of habitat changes associated with that route, or are they a reflection of dove numbers, period. As you're aware of, the landscape of Texas is changing tremendously. And so associated with these historic routes, the habitat has changed tremendously as well.
So you do use the same location year to year?
We do.
So you're comparing apples to apples?
You got it. But we've changed our method for detection of birds using the old and the new, trying to test for differences to see which is the most accurate or precise.
Brad, I have one question too. Are you all doing any research yet on collar dove?
We have done some research on collar dove. We've looked at actually the collar dove in the possible effect to mourning dove and white wing specifically, right. Specifically trying to determine the overlap or potential problems. We've done some initial research on that. We have some that we're considering now. But we have looked at the interface there, and at this point in time, we haven't seen any negative effect as far as displacement of those two birds. Now, as we have white wings moving more into urban areas, moving north, the potential there for some interface is certainly greater. So that's something that could appear more in the future.
Will white-winged dove displace mourning dove?
They're a little bit different animals there. Right. So, you know, where you typically don't have as many mourning dove nesting in a town and things like you do white-winged doves. And, right. And white-winged dove are more colonial nesters. And so you have a difference in a few individuals versus a colony of birds. And so it's a little bit different effect there. The way those birds respond to habitat and nesting structure substrate.
Thank you both very much. Excellent presentation.
Thank you. Very interesting. Appreciate your work.
I'm going to move to the item. Item eight.
Thank you.
Where we will recess for executive session. Conservation Committee item number 8 will be discussed in executive session. We will now recess for that executive session. Therefore, I'd like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act. We will now recess to executive session. Thank you. Time I would like to reconvene the Conservation Committee and go back to committee item, I believe it's number 3. The acceptance of land donation to Jalapinto County Possum Kingdom State Park. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners,
Well, chairman somewhere, I guess. Good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is the first reading of a proposal to accept the transfer of land from the Brazos River Authority to Possum Kingdom State Park, located in Palo Pinto County, actually just right on the lake, Possum Kingdom Lake, and about 60 miles, 70 miles west of Fort Worth. There are actually two tracts that Brazos River Authority and Texas Parks and Wildlife are looking at, each about 350 acres. Brazos River Authority would like to do those in two separate transactions. It turns out we have some submerged land on the lake that is an artifact of the way the land was surveyed and conveyed to us in 1939. The land is actually more of a liability than an asset to us. It's below the pool elevation of the reservoir. The Brazos River Authority would like that back, and we'd like for them to have it. You can see in this map the northern section of land in yellow would be the land conveyed back to us. It was actually conveyed to us in 1939 with the park. In the mid-1960s, Brazos River Authority proposed to take that land and put some low-density recreational facilities on it. We had not developed it at that time, so we transferred it back to them. In the meantime, they have not accomplished that, and I think we all agree that Parks and Wildlife would be likelier to complete a trail system and perhaps some waterfront facilities on that track if it were part of the state park. So the proposal is to convey that submerged land to the Brazos River Authority. They're now paying a small amount of money on a pipeline easement in the southern part of the park. We would just give them a permanent easement in place of the current term easement, and then that 350 acres would be transferred to Texas Parks and Wildlife. This is the first reading. We're requesting permission to seek public input on that proposal. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Commissioner Duggan.
You're saying that it's the this
no,
top...
Go to the next slide.
Yes, sir. That 355 acres in yellow is the portion that would be conveyed first.
And then eventually the next 355 acres.
We have requested that, and they have expressed a willingness to proceed with that transfer after the first one is completed. Yes, sir.
Part of the deal, or is just a possibility that'll be nice to do it?
We're operating on good faith at this point for that second transaction, yes, sir.
Am I correct that the BRA leases the shore frontage that's depicted there to the east?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Would we get those leasehold rights in case those homeowners break the lease or the lease expires?
We have not requested those, and that's not currently in discussion. Most of those are very small tracts, and the BRA is in the process of divesting interests in property on the lake, and I think the proposal they are currently considering is to actually sell those to the lease holders. And I don't think we really want a bunch of one-acre lots with cabins on them. We have not requested that.
Wouldn't it be a source of money if we were to have the reversionary, the lessor's rights and be able to sell them to the homeowner, or if we decided we were going to try to get the property back eventually? Wouldn't that be of some value to us, particularly where we own the land around it?
That's an operations issue. The State Parks Division has specifically not asked me to request those leases. I don't know if Walt Babney is here or not, but... I think the consensus is probably that would be more of an operational problem to manage those. And again, I think the intent currently is to sell those into private ownership of the folks that have actually built those homes and leased those properties all these years. We could certainly request a right of refusal going into the negotiation for that piece of property, but I would do that at the direction of my chain of command or the commission.
Why we wouldn't want to at least have the rights, and we decide we don't want them, we can always release them or sell them. But I mean, that's the most important part of that second tract, is to have that shore frontage. Maybe you all disagree. I think we'd want that. Carter, am I missing something?
Well, I don't know. I don't know enough about those leasehold interests. I guess why don't you let us explore that with BRA as part of this discussion, and let us look into it. And so we'll do that, and then we'll come back and report to you on that.
I just wouldn't walk away from it as if it has no value until at least it's considered.
Yep. Considered. Yep. Good counsel. We'll look into that.
We have a very good working relationship with BRA at this point, and it would be very easy to visit the site, to discuss with them the logistics for the transfer as they see it, and to come back with that information at the next meeting.
Thank you. Any other discussion, comments from the commission? Hearing none, I will ask staff to begin public notice and input process. Thank you, Ted. Committee item number 4, land exchange, Harrison County, Caddo Lake State Park. Once again, Ted.
Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is the first reading of a proposal to exchange small tracts, actually subdivision lots, adjacent to Caddo Lake State Park in East Texas. The state park is a contiguous or adjacent to the wildlife management area on the southern side. At this point, the park narrows down. These lots in question are front on what is essentially a river. It's a narrow part of the lake. The lot on the east that you can see in this map on the east, we were donated 10/11 of that lot about a decade ago, and in the last year we've been able to locate the other interest owner and get that donated. We now own the lot outright. The intervening property owner owns also the tract adjacent to the boat ramp, and just candidly, she's had problems with people trespassing. The fence is right up against the boat ramp. Children and adults have a bad habit of either wandering the shoreline or just jumping the fence to get away from the parking lot there. And so she has approached us and requested that we exchange lots with her. Staff recommends that very highly for operational reasons, because the lot we would exchange is not really contiguous with the park. And so we're approaching the commission and requesting permission to seek public input on a proposal to exchange those two lots.
Any discussion or comments from the commission?
The lot to the right is the lot we own currently.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And in her view, that's worth a whole lot more than the lot she owns on the west side.
She considers it to be less of a liability. Again, just to be very frank, the fence separating her property and the state park is a stone's throw from the boat ramp, and guys are bad about jumping the fence, and there's no men's room right there handy, and she would really prefer to have another 150 or 200 feet between her home or between her property line and the boat ramp.
I can understand why we'd like to have it, but it seems to me our property has more value than hers.
Well, no. Some additional information. That lot that we own has a home on it constructed in 1960. It is perched precariously on the edge of a pretty steep bluff. It is collapsed. The floors are soft. Somebody's going to, if that home isn't raised and removed from that property soon, somebody's going to go through a floor. It's a two-story home. And hurt themselves. It is quite a liability. And again, staff very, very strongly feels like. And the other thing to note is that part of this process by law is we would have to have a market analysis done on those two lots to make sure that the lot we receive has at least as great a fair market value as the lot we're giving up.
And would this proposal include her taking on the responsibility of that house? And
absolutely.
She wouldn't have any obligation to destroy it or remove it?
Absolutely. It's sort of as is, where is, and she would assume all responsibility for that structure.
Thank you. Good. Any other questions or discussion? Hearing none, I'll ask staff to begin the public notice and input process. Committee item number 5, acceptance of land donation, Bear County, Government Canyon State Natural Area. Ted, once again.
Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is the first reading of a proposal to accept the transfer of approximately 3,000 acres of land from the city of San Antonio. The property would be added to the Government Canyon State Natural Area in San Antonio, on the western, northwestern edge of San Antonio. The lands actually are in several tracts shown in red. These are lands that were acquired with prop monies for protection of the Edwards Aquifer Recharge Zone. There was some, my understanding is that there was some public expectation that there would be access, public access, low impact recreational access to these tracts. The city of San Antonio has not been able to provide that, and we believe, and the city believes, that in our ownership, that appropriate public access could occur. And it doesn't show real clearly in this map, but these really are just about the last vacant lands in this area, and probably the last opportunity we would ever have to significantly add to Government Canyon State Natural Area.
Ted?
Yes, sir.
I think I understand the red lines. The red lines are the piece of properties that's being conveyed to us.
Yes, sir.
What is the little red line down at the bottom left-hand corner?
It's a right-of-way. It's okay. An access right-of-way.
Access right-of-way?
Yes, sir.
Coming off of a road?
Yes, sir.
How wide?
I'd have to get into the deed and look at that.
Okay, but it's not a road now?
It's not. I couldn't answer that question. My guess is that it's simply a reserved right-of-way. There's probably a gravel road or a caliche road. I doubt it's a public road, but again, I would have to check the deed to find out.
Mark, I have a question. Is it proposed that Parks and Wildlife would get surface only or surface and minerals?
The proposal is to convey everything owned by the city, and I do not know how much mineral interest is included in that estate. They probably don't know. As you well know, it can be difficult to, without spending some money, to do deed research to track out where those interests are.
But do we want to take on property where we know the mineral owner can come in and use the surface for?
In this case, this is all occupied endangered species habitat. So between our authority and the federal takings authority, we could very much control the impact of oil and gas exploration on the surface.
When you say control, you mean prohibit, or do you mean?
No, sir. I mean we could limit the impact by determining, by working out the locations from which drilling could occur. It's a similar situation on about 3/4 of our lands where we don't own the minerals, and yet the minerals do get leased for oil and gas exploration, and we do have more authority than a private landowner would have to cite that impact in such ways to minimize the damage done to the surface.
Do we typically try to assess the state of the mineral title before we accept land donation or not? I think we should. I'm just curious.
Yes, sir, we should. What we do is we examine the title policy very carefully and determine what's owned and what's not owned. In the case of minerals that aren't owned, we don't have a budget to go try and acquire those.
I understand that. I'm just suggesting we ought to know before we accept this if the minerals or some portion of the minerals go with it. I would think we'd want to know that.
We will definitely know that. I mean, that'll be part of the title commitment in terms of what the city ultimately ends up conveying to us in fee simple interest. I will tell you, I'm pretty familiar with this area. There is not any mineral exploration activity of any real shape or form that's going on in this area. Now, what the probability of that is in the future is anybody's guess, but this is by no means in an active field that is being explored or really a historic field. So I think the probability of it is probably fairly limited looking ahead, but we absolutely will know what we're getting once they end up giving us a title commitment on this.
And will we know that before we're bound to accept it?
Yes.
We will know that before we bring this back to the commission for a second reading. Yes, sir.
Good point. Any other discussion on this particular item? If there is none, I'll ask staff to begin public notice and input process. As you will recall, committee items number 6 and 7 have been withdrawn from the agenda. Moving on to item number 8. This item was discussed in executive session, and there is no further action required. And, Mr. Vice Chairman, this completes the business of the Conservation Committee.